From favorite colors to favorite movies, our guest this hour says our preferences and opinions are frequently made by countless different forces, and we will discuss what accounts for taste. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, May 19th. Do you have a favorite food or color or song? Do you know why you like what you like? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you have a favorite color? Is it blue by any chance? Do you have a favorite number? Is it lucky seven? We'll find out why I was probably right with those guesses when we talk with our guest, Tom Vanderbilt, a writer, contributing editor of Wired, Outside, and other publications. He is the author of the bestseller, Traffic. We spoke with him then, and his most recent book is You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. And Tom is also a University of Wisconsin alumnus. Good morning and welcome back to Wisconsin via the radio.
Great to be with you again, Joy. Thank you.
Yeah, I often think of you, Tom, when a car zips in front of me, when there's a lane closure, and I'm going to get mad, and then I remember you told me that, that motorist was doing the right thing.
I thought my book solved all driving and traffic problems, but I guess there's still more work to do.
But you did. You opened my eyes to something that was my traffic pet peeve, and then I realized I was in the wrong, and the pet peever was in the right. But anyway, that was another subject, but it was a very memorable book. And so is this one. Why is it that my favorite number is number seven?
I mean, this is the thing that, psychologists began to study a while ago, but they were looking at things like colors and numbers, and they found blue and seven were so often reported to be favorites. They even called it sort of a blue and seven phenomenon. And blue is well, we can return to blue, but that's a little bit easier to figure out, perhaps. But seven is sort of a funny one. I think this is something my daughter asked me, though, because as I mentioned in the book, she was four at the time. I think kids of that age are obsessed with asking questions like this. They're trying to, you know, figure out their own early preferences in life. So she asked me what my favorite number was, and I thought to myself, well, I don't know that I really have one, but I gave her an answer. But a lot of people, when asked, will say seven. And the theory is that because seven does have this positive cultural connotation, it's a lucky number, it's referenced in various religious, key religious texts, that, you know, it somehow seems to have this extra aura, and it might just be the thing that people, that pops into people's head when pressed for a favorite. You know, otherwise, not something they really think about very often. And I began to wonder if a lot of our preferences might be, just sort of popping in our heads because we're asked. Not something that we really feel that strongly about, but we can kind of almost force ourselves to feel strongly about if the situation requires.
So number seven it does have that positive connotation of being lucky. I also graduated in 77, so I think that might have something to do with it. But you know what? My favorite color, I don't know if it's blue. I like blue a lot. I have a lot of blue clothing, but I think my favorite color is green. And is there some reasoning that you might be able to give me as to why that is?
Well, I mean, the whole theory, so my favorite color was, when asked by my daughter again, was blue. And I don't own only entirely blue things. I have not just, you know, entirely blue wardrobe, but I went to talk to a guy named Stephen Palmer at University of California at Berkeley, and he has this whole theory called ecological valence, which is a, you know, technical sounding term for the idea that when he asked people to look at things in the natural world that surround us and sort of rate how they felt about those things, and then he asked another group of people to look at colors and rate those things, I mean, the strongest correlation he found, what were the things that people felt positively about in the real world, were blue. So you can imagine some of the things there. You have clear blue skies. I mean, who doesn't feel good looking at this thing that surrounds, you know, I don't know the exact number, but a good amount of our daily life, just our kind of window of view. And you have, you know, oceans, water. So the connotations go on and on. There aren't that many really sort of negative connotations of blue in the natural world, things to look out for that might represent danger. So blue has shown up in a number of studies when people have done it as the favorite color. It's not a majority of a favorite color, but from a spectrum. And, you know, I sort of wonder, well, maybe we were just, born liking blue. That would be a nice explanation. But he says, Palmer said that, you know, infants, when you test them, they actually prefer this kind of color spectrum of yellow browns over blue, which actually are what adults favor least. So it kind of, you know, speaks to this idea that with a lot of things that we like and our taste, there's something that we've learned to like. We talk about this thing, acquired taste, and we always use that for something that's a little bit of a stronger taste, I think, you know, sort of like a whiskey or something like that. But I really think most of our tastes are actually acquired. So back to green, I'm sorry. Palmer's idea might be that, you know, maybe you live in a forested area and you're surrounded by surrounded by trees. Trees are a nice thing as well. And these things can be sort of toyed with. He's done other experiments where if you kind of go to New England in the fall and the leaves are changing and there's a lot of wonderful russets and browns, you know, people's liking for those colors goes up a bit. You know, people who went to the University of Wisconsin will like red a little bit more. We like what we know, what we're surrounded by, what we have good feelings by, and that kind of transfers over to the color.
So here's an acquired taste that I remember the first time that I had a sip of coffee. My parents were drinking, I'm sure, and it was awful. It was bitter. It was like, why would anybody, you know, volunteer to drink that stuff? And now I love it. So that is one of those acquired tastes.
Yeah, coffee's a great example, or alcohol, but coffee, you know, it is bitter, and the body is primed to reject bitter. You probably made what scientists call an aversive gape, which, you know, you kind of twist up your nose mm-hmm. and maybe even open your mouth a little bit. It's your body possibly preparing to eject that substance. We don't want to talk about that too much, but, you know, but over time, you know, and you probably put milk and sugar in it to disguise that, and, you know, over time, though, you begin to pick up those positive connotations that might be lurking in the coffee, which are, let's just say, caffeine.
Yeah.
But what's funny to me about that is that, you know, a few years go on and then you reach for that coffee and it's an acquired taste, but it's not necessarily the taste that you first had. You know, the whole coffee has changed in your mind. You've done something else. I mean, you're still getting that same sensory input on your tongue, but your brain has done a lot of work in the intervening years to completely change that coffee experience for you. So coffee itself has changed in a way. Or a better way to put it is that we've changed. The coffee stays the same, but we've become someone else through the consumption of that beverage.
Yeah, and I get it. And I'm now an early morning talk show host who wants that caffeine, I'm sure, too. I'm not getting that acquired taste when it comes to goat cheese, though. Everybody loves goat cheese. I'm the only person in the world that doesn't love goat cheese. Do you like goat cheese?
I do. It probably took a few exposures. This is something they talk about, especially with children, that, you know, it can be up to 10 exposures before something really hits home with children. But this, when I say exposure, by the way, this is a famous theory in psychology called mirror exposure, where simply showing, you know, people something or playing a song for them or having them eat something. You just having it a second time if they felt sort of neutral about it to begin with or were suspicious, it could increase their liking. And you can show, you know, Chinese letters to people who do not speak or read Chinese, and even something that they don't know, they will begin to like a little bit more the second time. So, you know, goat cheese is not, with the exception of things like sugar. I mean, there really aren't any foods that are just inherently likable. I mean, we require sugar, but I think everything can have a. But yeah, I signed up with goat cheese a while ago. But there were other things that fennel took me a long time.
I love fennel.
Okay, so there you go. But I just needed someone to make it for me the right way,
yeah.
Have it a couple different times, and then just to keep seeing it on menus as it became more popular in this country. I mean, it was always more popular in places like Italy. But and you go online, and I'm not alone. People, you know, talk about fennel aversion, and they don't like the taste, but most of the time, it's not biological.
You know what? I heard biologically there is a difference in people who like cilantro and those who do not. Did you find that in your research? Like, some people it tastes like soap, and some people think it tastes like heaven.
Yeah, there are certain genetic markers that show up. Another one is with something called boar taint, where people can get this kind of very strong animal smell as they're kind of preparing pork, which other people don't get. It's sort of a strong thing. So, you know, but even those people, you know, you can still overcome that aversion. Even people that are allergic to food, you'd think that would be, it would trigger the body to reject that food out of hand. I mean, you can still have a powerful liking for something and not be able to handle it. The thing that they say that really can trigger a full-on dislike of a food is to have a very bad experience where you have ended up being sick and violently ill and ejected that food.
Oysters. All right, I'll talk about that later, okay. Maybe. We are talking about why we like the things we like with Tom Vanderbilt, who is the author of You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We will find out why obscure songs like The Proclaimers' 500 Miles turned into global hits as we continue talking with our guest, Tom Vanderbilt, who is the author of You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice, a book about why we like the things we like, what accounts for our taste. And we welcome your questions for him. Are you unsure why you like something or why you dislike something? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you have a favorite color or song or food? Do you know why that's your favorite? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Tom Vanderbilt is a writer, a contributing editor to Wired, Outside, and other publications. He is also the author of the best-selling book Traffic, which we talked about on this show back when it came out. I'm wondering, Tom, what turned your attention from Traffic to taste?
Well, that's a good question. I wish there was a logical reason there. There really isn't. But I'd been having a number of things in my life that I was thinking about apart from my daughter's question about color, which, number one, just spending a lot of time online, consuming, you know, culture and buying things and finding that I was really running into both being asked what I felt about those things and asking to rate and you know, things like that, but then also being exposed to what other people felt about those. And it used to be much harder to have a sense of other people's opinion. You know, you sort of relied on only critics at newspapers, or you kind of had to just take the guy at the hardware store's word for it that this was the best hammer. But, you know, so I was just finding, and then often in a place like Amazon, people are not only reviewing the thing, they were kind of reacting to each other and sort of having these little arguments about taste there. And the last thing was just, you know, living in a place like Brooklyn, New York, which I now do, which is sort of hipster central, you know, I was fascinated by the way things that were once these kind of common everyday objects like coffee that we were talking about, you know, had been turned into these, you know, kind of connoisseur objects that, you know, suddenly there were new ways to prepare them and order them. And I would go into a coffee shop the way I used to go into a record store when I was in college and feel a bit insecure about what I was actually choosing. And I was thinking, well, that's sort of interesting. So there's just, surrounded by all these things out there, I was, you know, kind of wondering how I was now acting in the world and making those decisions.
Yeah, it's interesting. And when you brought up Amazon, that's where this You May Also Like comes from, because if you like that book, you're going to also like this book, right?
Yeah, it kind of comes to the whole collaborative filtering, as they call it, of recommendation engines. And, I mean, this kind of faces this. The problem all those organizations face is trying to interpret consumer behavior. If you buy, you know, one of the famous examples is you buy Harry Potter for your kid. Does that mean you then want a whole other list of kids' books? Or, you know, trying to interpret signals from the consumer is a very kind of murky thing. On Netflix, they face the problem of, do you go by what people say they like, or do you actually follow their implicit behavior? And now that they've shifted to more of a streaming model where you can kind of pick anything at any time, and start playing it, it doesn't matter as much how people rate that or what they say in their taste preferences, what they want. You can actually just see what they're doing. That often doesn't, as it turns out, match up that well with what they say they want. A lot of these companies are just trying to interpret what can be very vague signals.
Yeah, and some, I think you point out in the book that, you know, at Netflix, I might say, oh, yeah, I want this real hoity-toity foreign film, but then I never really watch it. I just picked it because I thought I should watch it.
Yeah, I mean, they told me that the DVD era, the DVD that stayed out the longest when it was rented, which you can use as a gauge to think that it took people the longest to watch it because it was sort of hard to watch in some way or did not exactly jump, you know, out of the envelope into the DVD player was Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. I probably had that at my house a few weeks before I watched it. It wasn't that I was watching it every night. It just, you know, it's sort of like something that was important but not, you know, the most pleasurable viewing, either the subject or the presentation. You know, it's kind of like, and this is, it gets into this idea of what, you know, the person we think we should be versus what we actually want to do at the end of the day. And I think you can think about this in terms of all sorts of things like food, you know. Inconvenient Truth is sort of, you know, the kale of films. It's really good for you to watch, but you know, there might be a bag of Cheetos right next to you that seems more appealing in the moment.
Why do you think it's important for people to know what accounts for taste or why they like the things they like?
I mean, you know, that's a very good question.
It's fascinating, but I'm just wondering if there is a bigger reason why we should figure this out.
I mean, one thing for me was just what's almost more interesting to me than likes are dislikes, because these are kind of more powerful in our psyche, and I have as many dislikes as the average person, I'm sure. And with the book, I was trying to, you know, examine those and think, you know, was I just sort of being lazy? I think taste at the end of the day is a way of filtering the world. I mean, we there's a lot of stuff we could possibly eat, watch, read, do, people we could hang out with, and at some point we just have to sort of draw some lines. But sometimes I think we draw those lines around things that we would actually end up liking if we just gave them a second chance. So I'm always just interested in these everyday behaviors that we're taking part in that become so everyday that we actually stop thinking about them. And so that was kind of my motivation.
So are you suggesting that I should try raw oysters again, even though I got sick on them on my honeymoon?
Yeah, you know, go to a reputable place in a month that doesn't end in Y or whatever the thing is there. And, we need multiple exposures for some things. It might turn out to be your favorite thing, you know, ever.
It might be. We are talking with Tom Vanderbilt, who is the author of You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. And we are discussing the science behind why we like the things we like and why we dislike the things we dislike. And we welcome your questions. We welcome any examples you might have. Can you explain why you like the things you like? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So, Tom, a listener called in, didn't want to stay with us, but wanted to, I guess, express her strong dislike of sauerkraut or cooked cabbage. She's disliked it since she was a child, and she can't believe anybody likes it. What do you have to say to her?
Well, it is a stronger taste, right? But I know of no biological aversion to sauerkraut, so. taste is very complicated. There could be some, and I don't want to psychoanalyze that caller, but, you know, who knows? There could be a certain negative emotional connotation, some kind of, bad experience eating it or eating it in the presence of someone they didn't like. And that's where, you know, taste is so open to all of these, you know, almost hidden influences sometimes. It's a very contextual thing. I often have this experience where I've gone on vacation and bought something you know, a piece of clothing or a bottle of wine, and it seemed amazing, and it seemed something I really loved in the place I was at. And then I brought it back home, and I opened the suitcase. I'm like, God, what was I thinking? I'm not going to wear this, or this doesn't taste as good as it did in that place, because what I really liked was the place I was in, the vacation I was on, the people I was with, and now that thing has sort of lost some of its luster. But I enjoy sauerkraut, so...
I do, too. That's a Wisconsin thing, too, on the broad, I guess. What she said she's disliked it since she was a child. Can you talk some about our... We touched on it, but how our taste will change over time? I guess our literal taste will change over time?
Yeah, I mean, taste is an evolving thing in our lives. We begin to acquire taste in utero, in the mother's womb, depending on what the mother is eating. That will even subtly begin to influence. They can have done fascinating tests where they can, when babies are born, if their mother was eating garlic, they will sort of, babies will tilt their head toward a sample that contains garlic. So already there's kind of a acquisition going on there. And, you know, we sort of ping-pong as kids between, at first they're open to everything, then they begin to get a little picky, then they sort of go back. But, I mean, again, you just, if there's any parents out there who are having trouble, just put it on the plate and walk away. I mean, because you just have to, if you want them to like it, you just have to keep giving it to them, with the exception of sauerkraut, perhaps. But, you know, as you do get older, you know, sensory-wise, your taste buds do, you know, lose some of their power. But, again... Yeah, I mean, it's an evolving process. It's an evolving process through the day. I mean, we like a certain range of foods when we wake up in the morning. We do not generally seek out much novelty. You do not meet your friends for breakfast at Indian or Chinese restaurants or some sort of, you know, food you're not used to. Usually, you want your cereal. By dinner time, we become more novelty seeking, more adventurous, and we might, you know, seek out new cuisines. So there's all sorts of ways that taste really change over different time periods.
Did you look into, and that just when you mentioned the Indian food for breakfast, it reminded me that I love Indian food and I love to go to Indian restaurants and I have to practically twist arms to get people to go with me. Why is it that some people love a certain cuisine and other people don't?
Again, I would probably just say exposure, and you know, you just have to have enough good experiences with something, and you need to have someone, you know, possibly walk you through it, explain it to you. It's really like anything, like art, for example. You can see a painting and have just kind of a neutral reaction. Someone might show you something in that painting or tell you something about the story of the artist who made it, and you will literally see that painting in another way. It's not the same painting you were looking at before, and I think a meal can really be the same thing, and you can just gain this new appreciation. This is sort of, you know, sort of appreciation 101, but I think we forget how powerful it can be. And you know, some people will say something like, "Oh, I just had Indian yesterday. I don't want Indian today." And I mean, that's a funny thing to me too, which speaks to, you know, another broad thing that's out there that influences what we want at any given moment. And it's an interesting phenomenon called sensory specific satiety. This is this idea that nutritionists talk about, that it actually begins the moment you begin to eat a food. You have this sort of intense desire for it. You begin to eat it. That desire starts to fall off the cliff and goes down. And what your body begins to send you a signal, essentially turning your like into subtle dislike, because it wants you to eat a sort of varied diet. It doesn't want you to gorge on any one thing too much. But even if you sort of feel full, if a new food comes along, that kind of resets the slate and your body, you know, sort of like, aha, it's time to eat again. So you can... actually, your liking jumps back up, and here's something new. This is why, at the end of a huge meal, we always magically have room for dessert. I mean, dessert is a pretty inherently likable thing, but it's, you know, this satiety thing going on again.
You know, here's an interesting question from Charles on Facebook, moving away from food now for a little while anyway. When my kids were young, my family went for several years without a TV by choice. As a teacher, this fact sometimes came up in lunch conversations with my students when, for example, a student would ask if I'd seen something on TV. Upon hearing of our television-less existence, one third grader thoughtfully asked, "If you don't have a TV, how do you know what toys to buy?" Which got me wondering, how much of what we think we like is what we are told to like? How much of this is really effective advertising?
I mean, whether it's advertising or some other, you know, external information, I mean, it's huge. I mean, there have been interesting studies done. I mean, just the way you label something, and there have been experiments done on radio stations and sort of blind taste tests where people were basically played the same bit of music or given the same exact food or shown the exact same piece of art and told it was either, you know, something obscure, something famous. Their whole feeling about that thing varies radically about what they're told it is. My favorite example is isovaleric acid, which is a substance that can be found in human sweat and also in cheese. So if you give people a whiff of this thing and tell them this is from sweaty socks,
ick,
obviously they don't like it. Tell them it's from cheese, they have a whole different same signal going in, but your brain sort of does something. So a lot of these things are what psychologists call driven by top-down processes, rather than bottom-up. It's coming from sort of a mental picture you have of that thing.
Oh, is that funny? I was thinking of goat cheese and sweaty socks. I'm sorry. Before we have a news break in just a couple of minutes. I think Charles's question was somewhat related to the 500 Miles song that I played just coming into this segment that we didn't get to yet. That this became a global hit because why?
Well, you know, with music, again, what we like the familiar. We like what we think we're going to like. So we listen to our favorite radio station. It's from a certain genre of music. We might not go outside of that genre. But sometimes in something like a Volkswagen commercial or a movie soundtrack where, you know, there's no information about what that music is, you have no idea what it is, you can't see the person, you're just free finally to kind of take it in with no preconception and have sort of a really open listening of that. And these things can become kind of hits, accidental hits later, you know, after they dwelled in obscurity for many years. The English singer Nick Drake, who was hugely obscure for decades after Volkswagen used his song Pink Moon in their commercial, he was more popular now than he had ever been in his life. And he was sort of, you know, an English folk singer who used strange guitar tunings and was a kind of a depressive person. And that's sort of a hard way to sell Nick Drake to someone and hey, you're really going to love this. But if you just actually play that song and no one knows what it is, people are running to the internet to, you know, sort of type in, you know, what is the song on that VW commercial, which is a search string on Google. So often we think we know what we like, but if we just have another way, our sort of can experience something without prejudice, without, you know, prejudgment, it turns out that's what we like.
Maybe we like a movie, too, if we didn't read the reviews, the critics that said it was a bad movie.
Yeah, exactly. Or my thing that always happens is I'll find something on an airplane when I'm sort of a captive audience. And of course, this speaks to something else, which I think is that we find many ways to categorize things, and that helps us like it. So you say, well, it wasn't the greatest film in the world, but for to help pass the time on a 2-hour flight or whatever, you know, it was pretty good. So we can. It's not like quality is only one thing. We shift our notion of what we want in a certain time and how we feel about that.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit more of 500 Miles as we go to news. And we have an open line for you. If you have a question about what accounts for taste, why do we like the things we like? Talking about our taste with Tom Vanderbilt, who is the author of You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a question or an example you'd like to share. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. So do you like the song, Eye of the Tiger? Why or why not? Do you like all kinds of music, or do you think certain types of music are far better than others? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking about why we like the things we like. We are talking about why we, out of so many different choices out there, we choose the things we choose. Our guest is Tom Vanderbilt. He is the author of You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the evolution of our taste, from everything from food to movies to music and more. And we're welcoming your input. So I use that example, Tom, because you used it in the book. It was the movie While We're Young. Ben Stiller's character is marveling at how his new 20-something friends are into all kinds of music. Their taste is apparently democratic. They like all highbrow and lowbrow and all sorts of music. And he ponders, he remembers when Eye of the Tiger, he says, I can remember when this song was just supposed to be bad.
Yeah, and I admit that I remember that time too, but and I am a Gen Xer, like Ben Stiller is supposed to be in that movie, but you know what they're sort of getting at there is that sociologists have talked about this thing called cultural omnivorousness, and that this has been increasing in at least the U.S. for the last few decades, where these lines that we used to draw, these very careful and distinct lines between what was good in quotes and what was bad, has sort of crumbled. So if you like opera, it doesn't necessarily mean you don't like hip-hop, or just, take any two other things. And people now choose randomly, and they can decide what's good and bad within those things rather than dismissing entire genres. But what I find is, as I get older, is that I still like the things I liked when I was younger, but the things I didn't like, I have kind of softened toward those as well, because I just don't have the energy to feel strongly one way or the other. And so, or maybe they were good all along, and I'm just having a new appreciation for something I was too quick to dismiss. This is, again, one of the mysteries of taste.
Rich on Facebook says, do some preferences derive from a prestige factor? For example, I like country music. I also like classical music, rock music, polka music, jazz, etc. I guess I am just drawn to music and to people who make music. But whoa, I have friends and relatives who, when they discover that I like country music, so much so as to go to country music festivals, etc., they really turn up their noses and say things like, really? Really? You hang out with those people? I nearly laugh my butt off. Those people? They're talking about me. Isn't there sort of a snob or prestige factor in what people like or say they like?
Yeah, I mean, I just talked about omnivorousness, but that's not to say those boundaries have still entirely disappeared, and they are still there. And I mean, a lot of taste is, kind of referred to as social learning, and who we're learning from is an important thing there. And there are certain tastemakers, or the idea of prestige comes in, that we might be picking that up. But another key point there is that we really do associate a lot together by taste. Researchers have done studies where they've looked at a person's Facebook likes and kind of made that person anonymous and just look at only the things they've liked, and have been able to tell a lot about that person, their gender, their sexual orientation, race, political affiliation. These sort of tastes we have can be, seem random sometimes, but they actually are pretty strongly associative, where you have a lot of shared interest with someone else. There's one of my favorite papers I came across doing research was, why do liberals drink lattes? Kind of going back to that old thing of, like the sushi-eating, Prius-driving, latte-drinking liberal. I mean, it's just a coffee beverage. Why should that be associated with kind of a political orientation? But these things sort of do matter, and they're very subtle in shaping how we feel about entire groups.
And I have soy milk because regular milk does not agree with me. Let's go to Tori in Waukesha. Hi, Tori.
Hi.
Hi, what's your point or question?
Well, it was said that, whatever you were brought up with is kind of what you did liked in the rest of your life. But I kind of disagree with that, because when I was a child, my parents didn't waver from what they were fed. I mean, we were fed the same deal, suppers that other people did. But my high school best friend's mom introduced me to Javanese Indian food. And that's what opened up my eyes towards all sorts of food. Now, I like Indian food, but I also like Mexican. I went to an East African restaurant. So I'm thinking that the introduction to different foods from my high school best friend was the one that introduced me to try anything. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure that, or I just want to know that it's not something you're brought up with, but it's something that you're introduced to at a relatively impressionable age.
Well, what do you say to that, Tom?
Well, I think, you know, we can encounter and experience new tastes at any stage of life. I don't want to say that, you know, some door closes. And I mean, I would say that it's your first thing is always going to be what you were brought up with. But that changes. I mean, just what you're talking about then, it's exposure, but just the exposure changed. You were exposed to new foods at a new time, so your taste evolved and shifted. I mean, there are things I've just begun to like in the last year that I was only exposed to recently. So, I mean, I think I just want to stress that there's no kind of door that closes here, and you know, life is full of adventure, and we're always going to be, you know, taste is always. This speaks to something though that people have studied, where a lot of us think that the tastes we have now are, it's been called the end of history illusion, where we basically think we are the person we are going to become, and that we're not going to change. They've done an experiment where they ask people to, how much would you pay to see your favorite band from 10 years ago play now, versus how much would you pay to see your favorite band now play in 10 years in the future? And people always privilege that future orientation because they think, well, I don't like that stuff in the past as much anymore. So, you know, I think we kind of forget, though, that we're always the tastes we had before are not what we have now, and the tastes we have now are not necessarily what they're going to be 10 years from now.
Yeah. I know, like we mentioned earlier, too, that yeah, as a kid, I didn't like coffee. Now I love it. And that first sip of alcohol, same thing. What about, though, this test? Talk about this test of ketchup in Germany and what the difference was.
Well, there was an interesting blind taste test done at a kind of a county fair where there were two samples of ketchup. And they were the same exact ketchup, except a small amount of vanillin or sort of vanilla flavoring had been added to one without obviously telling anyone. People were invited to sample both ketchups. It turned out a certain group of people preferred the one with vanilla. And they then tried to figure out why that might be, and they interviewed people and tried to get to the bottom of it and found that in Germany, infant formula has a small amount of vanilla added to it for sweetness. Turned out they found a very strong correlation between the people who liked that ketchup with vanilla had been bottle-fed as infants. So, you know, if you'd asked those people, hey, you must really like vanilla, or, you know, they'd probably, no. I mean, this was just sort of a subconscious taste from their earliest childhood that stuck with them and was still informing their behavior, but without even knowing it. And I think the psychologist Timothy Wilson has a great book called Strangers to Ourselves, which he argues that, you know, a lot of our actions in daily life kind of operate from these subconscious biases that we may not even know. So there's always a lot of that, I think, going on as well.
Yeah. You know, we haven't gotten to one of my favorite subjects. Why are some people cat people and some people dog people?
I think we need another hour for that. You know, and then there are, and some are both, right? I mean, that's maybe,
yeah,
that's minority,
I'm both, yeah.
But, and, I mean, people do change. I don't think you're born one way or the other. There's no genetic predisposition to dogs or cats. And you could probably make all sorts of arguments here. And then once you become a cat person, you might tend to associate more with cat people. And there might be associated tastes that are related to that. And you become to embrace the whole lifestyle because it's kind of about forming an identity. But how much it has to do with the actual animal in question there, I'm not sure. But this is a huge topic that...
Yeah, yeah, and I grew up with cats and dogs, and I guess I do like them both. And I thought about when you were mentioning likes on Facebook. Whenever I put a picture of my cat Ray on Facebook, the likes explode. People love cats on Facebook. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, presumably those are cat people liking it. I don't know how much crossover there is from dog. I mean, and I don't know if this has been empirically studied. Do cat photos generate more likes than dog photos? I mean, I don't know. The cliche is that dog people are sort of more extroverted and social, so you think they might do more of that liking. But maybe cat people are more introverted, and social media provides a way to express their kind of love for cats, other people in a safe way. I don't know. I'm just wildly speculating here.
Here's Justin on Facebook says, I think once you get older and move past the restrictions of what's presented to you by others when you're growing up, certain foods or top 40 music, clothing, etc., you start realizing there's more out there and you begin to form your own opinions of what you like and what you don't like. Is he right, Tom?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, this is why we travel, isn't it? Well, I was about to say we travel to experience new things. However, there is the phenomenon as well where people do travel to a foreign country and still eat at McDonald's once in a while. I mean, there's this. I think as humans, you know, we're always torn between familiarity and novelty. We crave both in some ways. I mean, we get bored with too much familiarity. We get a little bit frightened by too much novelty. It depends on who you are, of course, but. I think it really goes back to, there's an argument made that goes back to sort of our evolutionary past, looking for food for survival. You know, if there was an apple tree right in front of you, you would just eat that apple because it was safe, it was familiar. What's familiar is what didn't kill you yesterday, so I'm going to eat that same apple again. Maybe as you become, you know, your needs are taken care of, you start looking for a little bit more novelty, you start ranging a little bit farther out. Over the next mountain, you find a new apple tree. It's a different kind of apple, and it's a wonderful experience. And if it doesn't kill you, you might go look for that tomorrow.
Yeah, and I'm sorry we threw you with the Eye of the Tiger. We're we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Tom Vanderbilt is author of You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. Thanks to Nyasia Ellison for producing this program. Thanks as well to Brianne Chasso. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. It's On the Campaign Trail coming up next. We'll talk about vice presidential choices. And then tomorrow on Tell Joy Where to Go, we'll talk about fishing. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.